This narrator advises that the listener digest the following as entertainment. The showrunners behind it are neither six-figure filmmakers nor professional critics. They are casually critical.
Hello there, and welcome to Casually Critical, the podcast show starring two pals who love to talk about storytelling. I'm your fine host, Daniel Carpenter.
And I'm James Newton, your cordial co-host. Now, if you can't tell by our certain drawl, today we're going to be discussing a special entry into the murder mystery genre, so to speak. That's right, folks. It's Knives Out Stories continuation in Glass Onion following Benoit Blanc.
But does this vegetable have the layers as per its name? Or does it smell of something rotten? I guess you'll have to stay tuned and find out.
I do respect that adage, my friend. That is an excellent way of segueing us into the further pontifications to proceed from here on forward.
Now, if you're listening, don't worry. You can put your mind well at ease. We ain't going to delve too much into the spoiler territory until after the break, and we'll let y'all know when that's going down. But I'm going to switch my accent off. Okay. I can breathe again.
It's hard to do. It's hard to let it go once you start, you know?
Yeah, my mind didn't want me to leave. I feel disappointed now when I just talk normally. Like, what am I doing?
It's like, oh, man, this guy again?
Right? Exactly. But we're also here to talk about another guy again, and that is the Glass Onion, as we just talked about. And for some of you, you might be a little confused. Daniel? James? Doesn't this come out in mid-December? Why are you reviewing this so timely? And it actually had a limited theatrical run, and so we were able to nab some viewings in theaters. There's a lot to talk about. We have a lot of thoughts here in our show notes. But James, I'm going to leave the burden to you to kick us off here. Tell me your initial thoughts. If you could sum up your viewing experience of this movie in one word, and then unpack that said word, what would that be?
I will unpack my viewing experience in three words.
Oh, really, okay.
Quick here. I'm going to say it was simple on purpose.
Mm.
And by that I mean the plot, the mystery, the characters, all of those things I would say were simple on purpose. I can give you a quick plot synopsis of Glass Onion if you'd like. Just a non-spoilery one if you'd like. So for those of you who have seen Knives Out, welcome back. Benoit Blanc is making a return as the last of the gentleman sleuths. For those of you who haven't seen Knives Out, welcome. You don't need to see Knives Out in order to enjoy this film.
Right.
Benoit Blanc is the last of these gentleman sleuths, and he is called during the COVID-19 pandemic to a remote island with a group of eclectic moguls, ranging from a conservative Twitch YouTuber to a fallen, aged fashion model who's now selling sweatpants. All of these people gathered. We have influencers and politicians and moguls all gathered on this island for a party. And a murder mystery ensues. I'm not sure how much more I can say without spoiling, but it follows the threads of the original Knives Out in the sense that there's a lot of recontextualization that happens in the middle of the movie that makes the viewing experience all the more enjoyable. So, to step away from that a little bit, Daniel, give me your viewing experience in a few short words.
I will describe the movie in four words. I can't quite make my articulations as succinct as yours, but I will try. Here's my four words. The movie was lacking, but not disappointing.
Ah.
I've been mulling this over in my brain, because if you've listened to our Knives Out review, I believe last season, you'll know that I thought very highly of this movie. I believe I gave the movie 5 stars, and James did not follow me there. Severance was the first casually critical review to get both. You should totally watch Severance if you haven't already. But I thought and I think very highly of Knives Out.
Yeah,
I love it. It's a fun movie. It is my favorite. It is the most favorite approachable movie that I know. I could show it to anyone, my family, my friends. I could watch it alone.
Yep.
And still enjoy it. And I love it for that. And I thought to myself constantly upon viewing Glass Onion, is this as good as Knives Out?
It's a great question.
It's a hard question, and I don't want it to sound simple, but the long and short is the conclusion I've came to is I think in a few areas it falls short. However, to use a sports analogy, while this isn't quite the same in terms of the batting average, I would say it's in the same league as Knives Out.
Yes.
And if, honestly, the gripes that I have with this movie are so, they feel subjective, that if someone were to come up to me and say they thought this movie was as good or better than Knives Out, I wouldn't disagree with them. I would totally understand and respect that. However, I personally don't feel this is quite as good as Knives Out, but those gripes I have are so minute. This just doesn't seem as much in the vein of my movie as maybe Knives Out was. I don't know. Do you feel the same way, James?
I do feel the same way, yeah. Mm. And I honestly, watching this movie, whenever I hopped onto IMDb, because I'm an old codger and I don't have Letterboxd, but I hopped onto IMDb to rate Glass Onion and I gave it my rating. And then I went back to Knives Out and I gave it a higher rating because I had been taking Knives Out for granted. I was like, this is an excellent mystery thriller.
I'm glad you came around to it.
Yeah, like I loved it, but I always thought it was for subjective reasons. But now coming around to another Rian Johnson murder mystery, I realized that there's just a lot of things that Rian Johnson did in Knives Out. Just doing a list of things that he did compared to Knives Out, he just did more with Knives Out than he did with Glass Onion. Yeah. Were there a few things that he did differently in Glass Onion that make that list close in size to Knives Out? I would say there are a few things that he did differently that makes it stand out. And I do agree, Daniel, if someone came to me and said, yeah, I like Glass Onion just as much as Knives Out, I'd say, that's respectable.
Yeah.
But my tastes just aren't the same. Something important I should add is that I haven't seen this movie more than once, and I loved Knives Out even more after I saw it the second time, because there's little details everywhere in Glass Onion, and we can dive into some of those in the spoiler review, but one thing I will say that's good about both of these movies, but I'll say specifically about Glass Onion, is that your sleuthing skills are rewarded.
Mm.
Your skills of observation, of piecing together the threads, will be rewarded. If you watch closely, you will solve the mystery before our dear friend Benoit Blanc does. Mm. And that's what makes a good mystery movie. Whenever it's a blink and you miss it kind of detail that you can pick up, if you're smart on the first watching, for me, it's going to probably be on the second or third. So I don't know, Daniel, do you feel like maybe there'll be some more appreciation that comes after another viewing?
I definitely think so. There's a video essay I watched recently, and I shared it with you, James, where he really points out that Rian Johnson's strength is in the details.
Yeah.
Those little character choices that you're not going to pick up on right away, and it makes a good, rewarding second, third, fourth watch, etc. And I really like that. Honestly, any movie that goes out of its way to do those things that not everyone is going to pick up on is a winner in my book, or at least a participant award in my book.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of craft and filmmaking that I'm looking for with my movies. Now, James, I want to take us further into this review, but before I do that, there's something that crossed my mind as you were talking, and that's what you had to say during our Hoodwinked review earlier this season. Because in Hoodwinked, you talked about how, as a child, Hoodwinked had a significant impact on you because you figured out what was going to happen, and it made you feel smart. It made you feel like a junior sleuth, and you really enjoyed that. Does this feel more like a grown-up version of Hoodwinked, or does this hit you different in a few key areas?
So it did the same thing to me that Knives Out did to me, Daniel. I predicted a certain plot twist in Knives Out, and that didn't happen, and I was disappointed. And then I also predicted another plot twist in Glass Onion, and it didn't happen, and I was once again disappointed. Coming back to Knives Out, I realized the movie's probably better without that plot twist. I had sort of thought that maybe a certain character was alive all along, just to sort of spin a cool story. So I did not feel like I was much of a junior sleuth in this movie. There were details in it that I know that I missed that I will definitely catch the second time around. So no, I didn't feel very big brain by watching this movie. I don't know. Did you feel like a detective, Daniel?
I actually predicted a few things that did in fact happen. And honestly, it was a little disappointing in that regard. I'm used to my brain being inferior to others. And so whenever I'm proven wrong in a very ironic and perhaps cruel and twisted way, I'm actually disappointed. I expect murder mysteries to be smarter than me. And yet, in the areas I just talked about, in those twists that I did predict or guess on, it didn't ruin the experience. I don't know. And perhaps I'm giving myself too much credit. That's something we can unpack later in the spoiler review. However, for our listeners who are listening to this that are maybe interested in seeing Glass Onion or wanting to hear our overall thoughts, I will say if you're worried at all about an overall degradation in quality, don't worry.
Yeah.
The writing is just as sharp in this one as it was in Knives Out.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a line that really stood out to me that I want to share really quick. Benoit Blanc's talking to the aged fashion model you were talking about earlier, and she says, I'm a truth teller. Some people just can't handle it. And he responds by saying, it's a dangerous thing to mistake speaking without thought for speaking the truth. And the second he said that, me and the entire theater all went, ooh.
Yep. Yep. It's very good.
And it's a good line, but more importantly, I think it's something that a lot of people really need to hear. And in a franchise now that's all about finding the truth, I think having that discussion on what is the truth and who should speak it and perhaps how should it be communicated is also a very important dialogue to have. So the writing is just as sharp as ever. There is, however, a tremendous difference in the budget. James, do you want to unpack that a little?
Holy Toledo, yeah. You guys, Knives Out, for the most part, takes place in this bespoke mansion in Massachusetts. And this movie takes place on an island built by a millionaire, and all of his toys and all of his fancy rooms that he has for the guests and all of the gadgets he has put together and the paintings and the sculptures and the set pieces just in general are so lush and so over the top that upon seeing the initial teaser for this movie, I thought, oh, man, the budget's really gotten to Rian Johnson's head. But upon learning that it was about a millionaire and about his elaborate lifestyle and how the plot sort of hinges on that, I didn't mind it as much. It wasn't as much of a distraction once I realized, oh, okay, they have the budget and they're using it for a good reason, not just to make for extra elaborate eye candy, not just to make for spectacle, but to drive a point home. Did you have any thoughts on the budget or on any of the set pieces?
Yeah, I don't know if my worries were as specific as yours. I wasn't necessarily worried about Rian Johnson letting the budget go to his head, but I was worried that, you know, Rian Johnson spoke a lot about Knives Out and wanting to do it, how it felt, the vibe I get is it felt like a comfort film for him.
Mm-hmm.
He just got off of The Last Jedi. He was ripped apart for it, and then he proceeds to make Knives Out. And him and his brother, him and his family grew up watching murder mysteries, so there's a soft spot he has. And I was worried going into Glass Onion that he would trade that basic passion for bigger, better, mm-hmm. you know, more elaborate. And in some ways, while he has toned a lot of things up, he's also toned a lot of things down, namely the number of people in the cast. It's a smaller cast mm-hmm. than Knives Out was, but every character, you can tell there's effort put in to their eccentricities, to distinguishing them. They're very similar in a few key areas, but also they're very different in their motivations and how they got here and why they're on this island and maybe what they're hoping to get from this millionaire and their connection to him. So it's really brilliant how, yeah, they're all the same. They're all rich people, but they're also not.
Yeah.
And while they are caricaturized in some areas, just like in their Knives Out counterparts, they're also surprisingly human in ways that I don't expect. So I always appreciate that when Rian Johnson goes above and beyond in that regard.
Strangely enough, Daniel, even with a smaller cast, I do think a low light for me for this movie was that a lot of these characters felt a little more flat to me than the characters in Knives Out, simply because there wasn't as much time spent with these characters. There was a lot more time in the second act with Benoit Blanc and another character, and we just don't get as much time fleshing out the primary insecurities, the characteristics of the fatal flaws of these characters, and really connecting with them. I feel like in Knives Out, we got a better impression of a lot more characters because there was more one-on-one time between certain characters in Knives Out than there were in Glass Onion. There were some characters, for example, Lionel, I think I could probably tell you two things about him. One is that he works for the billionaire in his company. And two, he thinks his boss is an eccentric genius, and that genius has kind of come into question for him lately. Those are the two things I know about him. Mm. Compare that to somebody like Walter Thrombey. He works for the rich father figure in that, and we get to know him quite well. And he has plans for the company, and we have directions for it. He has directions for it, and there's conflicts there. And we kind of get to see who he is based on what he wants out of the will. There's just a little bit more, I feel like, for each individual character. I don't know if I articulated that well, but do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Knives Out does a brilliant job at fleshing out the characters, not just in the present day, but their past. Showing us some more intimate moments. And what Knives Out does quite brilliantly in the first 10 to 20 minutes is it shows us one thing in the flashback and then shows us another thing that they tell the detective.
Yeah.
And then they use that just a little bit later to a greater narrative extent. But it takes advantage of the cinematic form and it teaches us something about the character. And then that uses that to teach us something about our new knowledge of them in the present day,
right.
That they're blatantly lying. That there's an insecurity there.
Mm-hmm.
So it fleshes them out and it also establishes they're a flat out liar. Yes. So I see where you're coming
yes,
from.
Yes. Thank you for translating my bumblings. That is exactly what I mean. Just seeing how truly insecure these characters are through the irony within the editing. Mm. Just to zero in on Glass Onion, before we dive into spoilers here, what do you think are the three like strongest parts of Glass Onion for someone who hasn't seen Knives Out even, what makes this movie great?
The writing, the acting, and the risks that Rian Johnson takes with the mystery genre. The risks he takes do not pay off for me. I personally do not think they work as well, but I do appreciate the craft in doing that nonetheless and in taking that risk. I'm glad that someone is taking a risk with the mystery genre, someone that can see how it could be toyed with. And then the acting, like you said, now that you've made that example of Lionel, I liked Lionel, but now I'm realizing, based on what you were saying to me, I see where you're coming from. What I realized was Lionel himself is not a complex character. But the actor playing him, Leslie Odom Jr., does a fantastic job playing him. Yeah. And I think that's great acting, stupendous performance. comes when you have great actors and a phenomenal director.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Rian Johnson is no less a director, and I think these actors are no less talented. But you're right. I do think some of the risks that Rian Johnson takes with the story structure come at the cost of some of the characters.
Yep.
But I do sense through the story, I feel like that cost was not something Rian Johnson implicitly knew was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I think he cares very much about the characters, but I just think the story didn't leave a lot of room for it. So those are my three, James. How about you? What are your three strengths?
The visuals are really, really strong. The budget goes where it needs to go. And the little details that you pick up now and again that just tell you more about this island and more about the person that built it is really cool to me. And then also all the costumes are great, as they were in the first movie. I think the themes in this movie are strong. I think there's a lot of thematic pushes in Glass Onion that are bold and very clear, and sometimes too clear, but sometimes it hits just right. Like with that quote that you said earlier, Daniel, I think that was one of the best instances of the theme in action. But I'll say that's a highlight and a low light of this film is there's a very clear vision for thematically what Rian Johnson wants to say. And I give him props for that. I'm gonna steal your show note here, Daniel, about Blanc, if you don't mind. Something else here that I really like about Glass Onion is that we get to learn more about Benoit Blanc and his personal life outside of the mysteries. And we see him just starving for a murder or starving for something for him to chase because it's 2020. They're cooped up. It's quarantine. We can talk more about the pandemic being actually mentioned in this movie, which I thought was so weird.
It was.
We'll dive into that a little bit more later. I think that was another weakness of this film. But we learn more about Benoit Blanc as a character, which is cool. He's more of a mysterious force in the first movie. In this movie, we get to know him a little bit more. And he's actually even more endearing because he's on this island with all these freaks. Yeah. And the island is crazy. And he's just like a guy toddling around in matching shorts and shirt and an ascot. And he's just like, oh, I do declare that is an elaborate piece of architecture. And then he just moves on to the next thing. And I don't know. I just love it. He feels like someone said he was like a fish out of water in this movie. And it was really fun to see that.
And the little details Rian Johnson brings to Benoit's character. I didn't think you could improve on Benoit Blanc because he seems just the first Knives Out. He reeks of being iconic, even though he wasn't from a previous movie.
Yeah.
He just reeks of an iconic character. And Rian Johnson took him and I knew ahead of time that they were doing things to humanize him a little bit, to reveal more. And I thought, no, not my boy. He's great. You don't need to add more. But Rian Johnson adds him, but he says, shh, it's okay. I know you like Benoit Blanc, so I'm not going to add more so it violates his character. I'm going to add more so it makes him endearing, but in ways you didn't think possible. And I go, all right. And Rian Johnson shows me that not only can I trust him with character, but it also shows me that I don't think he intentionally wanted to make some of these characters more shallow than they are, because he really does care about his characters and he cares about these people, even though they're scumbags, most of them. So wrapping up, James, out of 5 stars, what are you going to give this movie? And perhaps you're compared to your score for Knives Out.
So I gave my rating to Knives Out into a 4.5 out of 5. And Glass Onion, I would give a 4 out of 5.
I gave Knives Out a perfect 5, and I am giving this movie a 4 out of 5.
Want to join the conversation? Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Casually Critical Podcast to get the inside scoop on future episodes. Feel free to message us on either platform to join in the casual correspondence or provide feedback on the show. Now it's time to dive into our spoiler review.
Okay, gloves are off, spoilers are on. We've got our mysterious puzzle boxes sent to us during quarantine, and we're trying to figure this out. So in figuring it out, might as well talk about the movie. Like I said in the non-spoiler review, I feel the major gripes I have with this movie are actually very subjective. This is objectively well done, very well crafted, but thematically, there are some things that I just don't like. But before I do that, let's just talk first about some of the things that were done well or just surprisingly well done. Namely, the character of Andy Brand.
Yes.
One of the risks that, for me, I don't think paid off super well was Rian Johnson takes the denouement, which is, I think I'm pronouncing that wrong, but it's where the detective essentially just describes everything, kind of lays it out plain and simple.
Mm-hmm.
We arrive there way sooner than I expect to where I go, okay, this is another fake denouement, because we had one at the beginning, which was for the fake murder mystery, which Benoit Blanc just immediately unravels.
So funny.
And Edward Norton's like, I paid a really good writer, like, a lot of money. It took a lot of work.
Yep.
But he completely unpacks the mystery right out of the gate, where I was like, oh, that's kind of fun. Like, it's a denouement that's pre-denouement. It's very early. But then crap hits the fan. The lights are turned out. Someone is shot, which one of the twists I saw coming was Benoit Blanc planting ideas that would happen. But then everyone goes into the room after Andy Brand is killed. And they say, what happened? And when Benoit Blanc's like, I have pretty much all the answers, but there's something in the core I'm missing. But here it is. And then we cut. Back, we do a flashback, and I go, wait, that was it? So that was basically the third act, but it was the first act, or the second act.
It was basically the end of the first, almost.
Yeah.
Or beginning of the second, yeah.
Yeah, and that's basically, chronologically speaking, that's the end of the second act, but it just happened to be the end of the first act,
mm-hmm.
because our second act is fleshing out the context, which was that Andy Brand has actually killed herself, and it's her twin sister. So one of the things that didn't work for me was the pacing. I felt completely out of it the whole time for that reason.
Yep.
I just thought, wait, so this is actually the sec, I'm confused. And then we go back to the denouement for a proper denouement, the third act, which isn't even the ending. So that's a lot to unpack, but let's process this one at a time. James, let's talk about this twin sister reveal and maybe the pacing in general. What are your thoughts on it?
The twin sister reveal on paper is pretty darn campy, but I think they pulled it off pretty well. I think both versions of Andy are charming. Sorry, Helen is the sister's name. Andy and Helen,
yeah.
Although it's Helen all along, are both very well done. I think it's interesting, and I think that they did it a lot better than anyone else could have. I can't imagine anyone else handling this much better. Honestly, the whiplash of Helen coming to Benoit's door at the beginning of the second act and saying, hello, I have a sister and she's dead. I'm like, okay, she's faking this. And this was the plot twist that I thought existed, which was Andy is actually alive and she didn't have a twin sister. So I don't know why she would do that, but I thought there would be like another layer to it. 'Cause Knives Out, you know, it's got three or four different layers over it. This movie just has two.
Oh yeah.
So there's not as much complexity here, and I was expecting more complexity. I just don't know how or where it was going to come from. And when it didn't come, I was like, ah, darn. The amount of time spent with Helen pretending to be Andy, going around and listening in on people and catching details that Benoit did not catch, or us, the audience, did not catch the first go around in the first act, I thought was a bit long. And I think that's where the pacing gets messy. And I think I would have loved it if Rian Johnson had put more of that time into developing our main cast earlier in the movie.
Yeah.
I would have been okay with that.
It does accomplish the exact same purpose as the first act, where we're still establishing character, fleshing out motivation. We're not really... The second act of the film, you really want to start jacking up those stakes. You want to start, the bad guys close in. Our heroes are in genuine peril. And the first Knives Out, or rather just Knives Out, does something that was haunting to me. And that was that character you mentioned, James, the one that, you know, we thought was going to make a comeback and all of that. Their death was haunting.
Yep.
Because it was accidental, because we didn't intend for it to happen. Because they didn't intend, but it happened. And it was haunting and adds this air of, oh, dang. And when Andy Brand, or rather Helen, is killed, that was an element that I thought was quite good. It was building to that point, because this whole time we're establishing her relationship with Benoit Blanc and them working together. I thought, oh, but I know how this is going to end. Mm-hmm. And then it was a double twist. She's alive because the book saved her. And that, I thought, was a bit campy.
Yes.
Because I thought, if she had just died, and when Benoit Blanc was crying over it, her corpse, that to me would have really stood out. Benoit Blanc tried to play the system. He tried to be clever. And he even tells her in the beginning, I can't guarantee your safety.
Mm-hmm.
And she dies anyway. And I would have wanted that to stay in there because of the sting.
It was foreshadowing something that never happened. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was false foreshadowing.
And again, there's craft in that, right? Because Rian Johnson knows the cinematic language, planting thoughts and foreshadowing. God of War Ragnarok, without spoiling anything, does something similar where they foreshadow something that doesn't actually happen.
God of War Watch.
But I just, again, didn't like it. Didn't stick with me. And perhaps the pacing is the only objective thing that I think was off about this movie. But again, there was a deliberation, and I never felt like Rian Johnson was just like, oh, I don't know. Let's just see if this works.
Yeah.
Like, I see his thought process. I see why he did it, and I appreciate it, but I don't like it.
Yep. I think another thing that was deliberate, but I didn't appreciate, was the fact that our killer was a total moron, and his thought process was second to nothing. Did that make thematically a very strong story? Yes. Did it make for an excellent movie? Yes. Did it make for a good mystery? No, not at all. Because it's a weak and lazy rich dude who is borrowing murder ideas from Benoit Blanc. For that reason, it makes sense. Like, oh yeah, he's a rich, lazy dude. We've seen examples of him being rich and lazy throughout the entire movie and stealing ideas from people. You know, that's the undertow of everything propelling this forward. So it's brilliant in that way. But at the same time, that doesn't change it from being a very simple, straightforward mystery. And it would have been much shorter if not for the way that it was paced and the way the editing kind of rearranges the story. It would have been a very short mystery.
Yes. And I thought there were some seeds of question marks, some things I didn't quite know that made me feel this was a pretty significant mystery. And then once everything was revealed, I felt more underwhelmed.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh my gosh, where's this? There's this, there's this. Edward Norton's character lasted so much longer than I thought he was going to. And
yep.
It didn't happen. And that scene where they're all at the dinner table and Benoit Blanc's like, shall we begin the murder mystery? And he's like, yeah, sure. And then Benoit Blanc denouements everything. I was like, that's kind of fun. But it felt underwhelming.
Because
mm-hmm. This whole time I thought there was a bigger mystery. I thought Edward Norton was going to die, or someone was, and then there would be this progression of people would continue to die.
Yes.
Until Benoit Blanc found out who the killer was. I thought that's how it was going to go. Frankly, though cliche, it would have been awesome.
Yeah.
The tension keeps racketing up. And these characters, maybe that would have given us a chance to unravel a bit more about them as it goes on. I don't know. I don't know logically how that would fit in, and I do not consider myself qualified to write a good mystery movie.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, when everything was revealed, the chips were down, and we learned everything, I thought, that's it. That's it.
Okay.
Just a stupid rich man. All right. That whole connection of Benoit Blanc saying, you know, you type kind of person, you turn the lights off and you shoot someone. Like, it... I made that connection pretty early on, and I was like, it might be him. It might be Edward Norton. But then it was revealed, and I was like, oh, I kind of, it reminded me of that twist in Incredibles 2, which I won't spoil. I don't really feel bad about spoiling it, but I won't. But we learn about this villain, and frankly, I predicted them very early on.
The first shot they're in, it's like, oh yeah, it's them.
Yeah. It's like, oh, it's them, right? And then they were like, we're not saying it's not them, but maybe it's them, him or her or them. And I was like, it's them. It's definitely them. And they're like, it's them this whole time. And I went, kind of hoping it wasn't them. But I want to, James, I want to come clean to you, okay?
Do it.
The ending bothered me. And this is when I'm talking, when I was talking in the non-spoiler review about my subjective gripes with this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It started out with the COVID-19 stuff, because we had our mini review on the Parks and Recreation quarantine special and how that did not go very well. And it started there, and then it escalated to the ending. And I thought, the ending, let me unpack this a little bit. Helen had the one piece of evidence and the billionaire destroys it. And I was like, shoot, you're right. Detectives can be good at putting all the pieces together, but if you don't have evidence, what can you do? And there's this moment of what happens. And Helen goes to Benoit Blanc for answers, and he says, my jurisdiction ends here. And then as he leaves, she shatters statue after statue, vandalizing more and more and more and more. And then it all climaxes into using experimental hydrogen-based power to destroy the house, burn the Mona Lisa, and basically screw him over. And I overheard someone say in the theater as I was leaving, he was talking with his friends, and he called it vigilante justice. And I was reminded that this irked me the exact same way it irked me when I saw Joker, which was this theme of the law will fail you at some point, society will fail you, so the best thing you can do is burn everything down and live out your truth. And I don't like that as a theme. I think that's dangerous. But I want to know your thoughts, James. What did you think about that?
I agree with you, and I think it's absolutely what Rian Johnson was going for. I think it is a political ideology that exists in the world that many good people believe that is the only way to bring about change is violent revolution. We've tried long enough trying to play the game by the system, and the only way we're going to make change now is, and the only way we're going to get attention now is through violent revolution. As a person sitting atop the status quo, I don't feel like I have a good perspective to share on that, but I do disagree. I think from a philosophical, religious point of view, I disagree with that ideology. I think the film executes on that idea super well. Did it make me a little uncomfortable? Yes. Was it supposed to make me uncomfortable? Yes. Did that make me change my mind about it? No. No. I still believe in nonviolent protest. This isn't going to change my mind. I'm not going to loot or burn anything down. First of all, because I have nothing to complain about as a white Protestant man, but also because it's not the morally right way to bring about change, and it's only going to harden the hearts of your opponents, in my opinion. So thematically executed great. Message was not one that I agreed with. And they burned the Mona Lisa, Daniel. They burned the Mona Lisa. You can't do that. You can't do that. It honestly felt wrong. It's weird, Daniel. It felt wrong to me, partially because it detaches me from reality. We know that nothing like this in reality would ever happen. The Mona Lisa is untouchable. There's no way this would ever happen. So there was disbelief, which is maybe what Rian Johnson was going for, but it took me out of the movie. But then also, it just kind of felt sacrilegious. I don't know. This is a cornerstone of art and also a recurring motif in the film. You know, Helen's face slash Andy's face were constantly compared with the Mona Lisa in the way that the camera was positioned, and we couldn't tell if she was smiling or if she was frowning or what she was thinking about, which was cool and a cool recurring image. Along with a few other things that I really appreciated that were recurring. But to burn the Mona Lisa at the end felt morally wrong to me. I don't know. It's something spiritual in me that just, it feels wrong.
That's interesting.
It's like if, It's like if in Mission Impossible they blew up the cathedral in Notre Dame. This is a beautiful icon of human history and fine art and culture. And there are certain lines that I don't want to cross when I'm watching a movie, and that's one. I didn't even know until I saw this movie that it was a line, but it is.
I totally get what you're saying about groundedness, because this movie starts very grounded. It talks about COVID-19. It goes through basically a fictitious, it plays as a historical fiction.
Yeah, it does.
It's COVID-19. They're in lockdown. They're in quarantine. And at first I thought, oh, this is a touch bit like political, but it's a bunch of rich people not wearing masks going to an island to just relax and get away. And honestly, that was true enough to life where I thought, you know what? Okay, I'm hands off this. I get it. That was life during quarantine. I get it. There were some places around here that were very strongly politically leaning one way, and they did not wear masks at all, even during lockdown. I was told that when I moved here. So there are definitely people that do that. And so I was like, okay, all right, fine. But then it starts in grounding, and then it progresses to destroying an iconic piece of art that a billionaire used his influence to get.
In the name of revenge.
And that didn't even happen during COVID-19. And I feel like the climax was deliberate, because you have the burning down of a rich white man's home by a black woman in protest of an unfair exertion of power and oppression. That's deliberate to me.
Oh, yeah.
And that also happened during COVID-19. So I don't want people accusing me of reading too much into this, because I'm very confident about this one. But regardless of your feelings on that, here's my problem. By burning the Mona Lisa and destroying his property, blowing up his house, I'm not here to talk about if he deserved it. First off, and I'm going to take my head out of the movie for a moment, he's a fictional character, and they made him more of a pinata in that scene just to beat him up and kick him around. Here's what bothers me. They're threatening his life. They're threatening lives of other people. They are leaving him with nothing. They're taking away everything. And what I saw in that is they are stooping down to his level. This slime ball, this man, again, I know he's a fictional character, but what did this fictional character do? He screwed over his friends, used them, took everything from them, even their lives, even risked taking away more of their lives. And what do they do? Now they've done the exact same thing. And his friends, these disruptors, they are still just as shallow. There is nothing left that challenges them. All they've done is they're vultures, and they're feeding off of his money. And when he has lost everything, they finally say, okay, screw you. You have no money left that I want, so I'm leaving. In Knives Out, I'm going to get more in a spoiler here for Knives Out, so if you haven't seen it, please maybe skip ahead, time skip a little bit. Marta ends up inheriting the house from Harlan and the Thrombies and all of that. And at the very end, there's a mug that Harlan has, and I believe it says something along the lines of, bless this house.
My house, my rules, my coffee.
Yes. That fun little mug. And at the very end, the last image, one of the closing images of the movie, is Marta holding it in such a way where her fingers block most of the words, and it just says, my house. And the fact that this family that pretended to love this immigrant, that pretended that they would always financially provide for her, have technically done exactly that. They have financially provided for her, and yet they are at their peak of bitterness, but they can't do anything about it because their own father turned against them because he realized what a crappy father he was and what terrible sons and daughters he has raised. And she's been left with everything, and they've been left with nothing. And they have to stew in that. And I thought that was a perfect defeat for them. Transition over here. You have this vengeful twin sister that's taken everything away from the billionaire, from Miles Braun, who feels like a caricature of Elon Musk and Steve Jobs, and he even wears the same Steve Jobs outfit that he does during the flashback scenes with Andy.
Yep.
But it doesn't feel like the bad guy's been defeated. It feels like we've been defeated. It feels like we've finally become the evil that we've been trying to destroy.
Mm.
That unsettles me, regardless of what your political affiliation might be.
Something that Benoit Blanc says to Marta near the end of Knives Out is, you didn't win by playing their game. You won by being a good person. Mm. And when you compare that so blatantly to Helen / Andy, I feel like there is a moral kind of stooping in comparison. And as a movie, it's entertaining to see. First of all this beautiful glass stuff set up that we've seen so many times teased. The motif of glass, you know, coming back over and over again, sort of as a symbol for Edward Norton's character and how hollow he truly is and how everything that he is nothing. He's nothing. Everything that he is someone else. He hired them to do something else. He stole something from someone else. So seeing all that stuff get shattered, it's very cathartic. The explosion parts are not as cathartic for me. I do think she does become sort of a villainess in that part. As there's still some catharsis that comes there because there is some setup in the clear with a K fuel and the explosive Hindenburg element and all that. Yeah, there's some catharsis. But it does make the viewer walk away with a weird taste in their mouth saying, huh, who was the bigger man here? Who was the bigger person? I don't know. I don't know who was the bigger person. I'm not sure. I wanted to loop back around to what you said about the pandemic. Do you think it took away from the story? Do you think it was just there? Or do you think it benefited the story in any way?
Maybe I'm biased. I don't know. If I could go back in time and pluck a World War II veteran and make them watch Saving Private Ryan, would they feel the same way? I mean, I guess I technically know that answer. They suffered PTSD while watching it, most of them. It's weird. When you're making an entertainment medium and you're referencing recent or past events in history and using that as the backdrop for a fictitious or partially factual or completely factual story, who suffers because of it? And I'm not trying to say, like, we should not make movies about wars or pandemics and cover our ears and say, la-di-da-di-da, life was great in every single decade, in every century. Bubonic plague, schmubonic plague, didn't happen, you know? I'm not saying that. I'm not saying we should. But I think I'm starting to feel that in a very weird way. I'm starting to feel very similar things to what those World War II vets felt. No, I wasn't shaking or having a PTSD flashback like quarantine. Why did you say that word?
No,
that wasn't me. But I felt uncomfortable, and not in the way you and I talk about, James. I'm not talking about the good kind of uncomfort we want our audience to sit in. I'm talking about disturbed. Not disturbed in a moral way, not what we were talking about with the ending, but just in a, this seems too soon. It felt like something died and now we're talking about it and I'm like, I'm not ready for that. Maybe when I'm 50 or 70, God willing, you know, maybe we could talk about it then, but it felt too soon. And given that there's still remnants of the pandemic, given the fact that some areas still have masks, hospitals still require masks, and even ignoring masks, just the political polarization in our culture that has taken place, the lack of wanting to hear out other people and opposing sides when it comes to their thoughts on things, because we think we've got it figured out. That stuff is still there, and that hasn't aged well for me. So it was a risk, sure. And I know that Agatha Christie and other great mystery writers have used political backdrops to comment on certain things and use mysteries to provide insight on that. And it does match Knives Out in tandem. Knives Out was more about Trump era politics and Glass Onion is more about COVID era politics. So I get it. And there's thought. but I wasn't a fan. Maybe that's subjective. I don't know, but that's just me. What about you?
I think for me, it was just awkward. It's like, oh, you had a choice to nodding.
No PTSD flashback.
No.
No.
No, for me, I was just like, we're doing this right here, right now.
We're doing this.
We're doing this. Yeah. Like, they had an option not to. They could have not done it, but they did it. And I don't know why. I don't know why. It takes me out of the story. Takes me out of the world. I get that it takes, like, they want it to take place during 2020. But why?
I don't know if... Maybe it's Netflix.
Maybe it is. Yeah, I don't know. But what other... This is the first movie I've seen in theaters, Daniel, where people are wearing face masks and talking about COVID, and Benoit Blanc's playing Among Us in the bathtub. Like, why? Like, I don't need
to be reminded of Among Us. There's an imposter in the engine room.
There's an imposter in the glass onion. It's Helen.
I will say I do like the detail Benoit Blanc said, like when Helen's like, you ever thought about playing Clue? And he's like, nah, I can't. Do stupid, you know. It's
just, yep,
I love that. And even in the Among Us, like, oh, you'd think Benoit Blanc would be good at it, but it's just so stupid and down to earth, and there's just not enough clues, and you know, that's fun.
Yeah,
but I see your point, James, about COVID. Like, seeing these actors with face masks on, and not really because they have to for filming. I don't know the exact conditions for that, but because the story was there and it demanded it, it felt weird.
The story didn't demand it, though.
Well. When you write it about COVID and you say the person wears a mask, it technically demands it. It doesn't.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me reword that. I see where you're coming from. The story put them in a place where they had to add that as props. They had to have them wear face masks.
Yeah.
They could have written it another way, but the context required it. The context demanded it.
Mm-hmm.
Abby Frisco said something in our She-Hulk review, shameless plug. Where she said you need to be careful about injecting too much of reality, too much realness into your property. With She-Hulk, it was a bunch of mean tweets that She-Hulk gets where they took real internet trolls and haters and they put them in the fake, fictitious Marvel show. And in a world that's being polarized, that's incredibly aggressively, as we've said, propagandic, that's a game I never want to play as a storyteller. I might inject my own agenda into things. I think every storyteller does, whether they know it or not. But I will never do it to that blatant of a level, to that place where I don't want people that consume my stories to feel alienated.
Yeah.
To feel like, oh, if Daniel is believing this and is projecting this agenda onto this, and I don't agree with him, I don't want to feel left out. I don't want to feel not included in that story.
Here's the only reason I would see this existing. When I compare it to Knives Out, I think about the fireside conversation where they're all talking abstractly about Donald Trump and immigration.
Yeah.
And we learn about each character just a little bit by the way they talk about it. And in the same way with the pandemic, we get to see a little bit about each character based on what they're doing. So, for example, Birdie J is having a big party and Yo-Yo Ma is there. Why is Yo-Yo Ma there talking about music? I don't know.
Mm.
She's having a big party. So that tells us about her. And then, you know, we've got Dave Bautista's character. He's in his mom's garage. You know, that tells us some more about him and how he's a he's a male rights advocate, and yet here he is living in the shadow of his own mother and depending on her for everything, hand and foot. And she is clearly a smart woman, and he is not an intelligent man. So we learn something.
I will say Dave Bautista's character, the one thing I like about him is, first off, he's an older influencer. I don't see a lot of them being mm-hmm. represented in movies. Not that they need to be represented. That was a very poor choice of words on my part. Glad to see them being acknowledged, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I like the fact he wasn't trying to be annoyingly hashtag relevant. He was showing a different side of influencers.
Yeah.
But what I didn't like was, oh, whoa, an all-powerful influencer that seems to have his life under control. It's actually living in his mom's garage and is a slave to his mommy. It's like, oh, never seen that one before. How original. I don't know. For a very sharply written script, that one felt a bit cliched and tried.
I think it would have been bothersome to me if it was something that they kept diving into, but it was like a 3-minute bit, and I was like, okay, yeah. Like, he literally just walked off screen talking about men's rights, and now his mom is telling him how to solve this puzzle box because he can't, you know, he can't tell the difference between a hammer and a chicken leg or whatever. I may have said everything I could say about Glass Onion at this point, but just to highlight this once again, the little details. If you were smart enough, you would have noticed the switching of glasses. Like, you would have seen it up front whenever Edward Norton hands Dave Bautista his own glass. It's you can see it. It's right there. There was one other. Oh, you can very slightly see Birdie's bag jostle whenever she's talking with her assistant. And whenever Helen is dropping the recorder into her purse by the poolside. There's a couple details that I did not notice that I will later, and I'm going to say, if you were smart enough, you would know. It's just little things like that that I really appreciate. Also, the red herring in Daryl, the weed-smoking dude who's going through some stuff and is just staying on the island. I love that. I was not expecting him to become something, but if he did become something, I would say, what a plot twist. But he was a good red herring for me.
I feel like Rian Johnson knows he's detail-oriented, and there's all these sensory things. There's the Mona Lisa constantly, and it's just played up so brilliantly. Mm-hmm. And then Daryl constantly interjecting into scenes. At first, I was annoyed. I was like, is he going to be someone later? But then I realized it's just adding to the noise. It was constant, like, so much is going on, and any brain power you focus on Daryl is wasted because he doesn't really do anything.
Because you wouldn't have noticed Duke's phone in Miles' back pocket, because you could see it on screen at different times, even whenever he was like, I don't know where it is. Can't wait to watch it again and pick out those little details.
In summary, I have my gripes with Glass Onion, and I know you do too, James, but it is refreshing to see something this sharply written, this original. For all the bad that it could have been, I'm okay with what we've got. I'm okay with it.
Yeah. So that's about it, folks. We've been James and Daniel, and I hired Agatha Christie to write the script of this podcast. So thank you.